A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been on a stationery and marking binge, prepping for a move, and he's noticed something. His favorite products, the stuff that actually works, keeps coming from two places, Germany and Japan. Edding industrial markers, Philips shaver heads, modular storage. And it's not just the products, it's the documentation, the manuals, the spec sheets, the assembly instructions. He's asking what it is about these two cultures, on opposite sides of the planet, that produces this same kind of excellence. And honestly, I've been thinking about the exact same thing ever since I opened an Edding 780 technical datasheet, and felt genuine delight.
The Edding 780 is a masterpiece of a marker. It writes on oily surfaces. It writes on greasy surfaces. It writes on wet surfaces. It survives minus 50 Celsius and plus 400 Celsius. And the datasheet doesn't just say, works on most surfaces. It lists 17 substrate types with expected adhesion ratings and chemical resistance for each one, including which specific solvents will remove it. That's not documentation.
Because if it were just cultural character, you'd expect it to be inconsistent. Some generations would lose it, others wouldn't care. A love letter to functional reliability. That's the most Herman Poppleberry sentence ever uttered. But you're right.
Let's start with Germany, because the mechanism there is unusually legible. The centerpiece is something called the Dual Vocational Training System, Dual Ausbildung. There's absolutely something structural going on. And the structural thing most people miss, especially in the English language coverage of this, is that German engineering culture isn't really about the big brands everyone knows.
So we're not talking about a handful of apprentices in traditional crafts. This is the default pathway for a huge chunk of the population.
And the structure matters. Apprentices split their time between a company and a vocational school. They're learning theory in the classroom and applying it on the factory floor in the same week. The middle stand is the ecosystem of small and medium-sized enterprises in Germany, often family-owned, often in tiny industrial towns you've never heard of, that dominate extremely specific global markets. The researcher Hermann Simon coined the term hidden champions for these companies. Germany has over 1,300 of them. These are companies with more than 50% global market share in things like laboratory glassware or industrial connectors or, and this is my favorite example, Fischer Fixing Systems.
The wall plug people?
The wall plug people. But calling Fischer the wall plug people is like calling Toyota the car people. It's technically true and completely misses the point. Fischer's UX wall plug documentation includes torque specifications, substrate compatibility charts, installation temperature ranges, information that most competitors bury in technical datasheets that only engineers ever see.
The documentation becomes an afterthought because nobody involved in producing it has skin in the game about whether it's actually useful. It's a compliance checkbox.
And in Germany, the legal framework reinforces this. There's something called the Produkthaftungsgesetz, the product liability law. German manufacturers are legally obligated to provide adequate instructions and warnings. And that's not an accident of culture. It's an output of a very specific system. Germany has something called the Duales Ausbildung System, the Dual Vocational Training System. About half of German secondary school graduates go into apprenticeships rather than university. They split their time between classroom instruction and on-the-job training at a company.
Which explains why the Edding 780, the industrial paint marker, doesn't just say, works on metal. It specifies surface preparation protocols for 12 different material classes, curing times, chemical resistance data. The person writing the manual has actually used the product. If it fails because the surface wasn't prepared correctly, and the manual didn't specify, that's a liability problem.
It's written by people who understand what the worker on the factory floor or the customer at home actually needs to know. These aren't regulations exactly, they're voluntary consensus documents, but in practice, if you want to do business in Germany, you follow DIOM standards. They create a shared language. When a manufacturer says, this bolt conforms to DIN 931, everyone in the supply chain knows exactly what that means. The thread pitch, the material composition, the torque tolerance. You'd start your apprenticeship at 18, splitting your week between a vocational school and the company floor.
It's like everyone agreeing to use the same alphabet. You can still write terrible poetry, but at least nobody's arguing about what the letters mean.
Not formally, just notes. But you're building the habit of recording technical information. By the third year, you're probably contributing to the actual documentation. You're the person who notices that step 4 in the assembly guide is ambiguous because you just spent an afternoon confused by it.
Let's pivot to Japan, because I know the mechanism there is different, but the outcome is strikingly similar. What's the Japanese equivalent of the Dualeosbildung?
Japan doesn't have the same formalized apprenticeship system, but it has something arguably deeper, a philosophy called monozukuri. The word literally means the craft of making things, but it's more than that. Contrast that with a typical American company where the technical writer is in a different state, working from a product requirements document that was written 18 months ago by someone who's since left the company. The German apprentice turned documenter has what I'd call tacit knowledge, the stuff you can only learn by doing. They know that the pump sounds different when the bearing is starting to fail. That's not in any spec sheet, but it might end up in the troubleshooting section of the manual as, if you hear a high-pitched whine during startup, check the bearing clearance before continuing operation. And here's the thing about Kaizen. It requires documentation. You can't improve a process if you haven't written down what the current process is. So documentation becomes embedded in the workflow, not bolted on at the end.
The manual isn't a separate product. It's a snapshot of the current state of the process, which is always being revised.
And there's another concept, the takumi, the skilled veteran. In Japanese manufacturing, there's a recognition that some knowledge can't be fully captured in writing. It's embodied in people who've done the work for decades. But the Japanese approach isn't to shrug and say, well, it's tacit knowledge, can't document it. It's to work obsessively at translating that tacit knowledge into explicit procedures. The takumi works with engineers to figure out how to teach what they know.
Of course there are. Standards for standards. That's the most German thing I've ever heard. The Japanese system takes people who've developed intuition through decades of practice and reverse engineers that intuition into teachable form.
If every manufacturer uses the same format for spec sheets, the same terminology for describing tolerances, the same testing protocols, then a mechanic in Munich can read a data sheet from a supplier in Hamburg and know exactly what every number means without translation. It creates a shared language for precision.
That shared language means you can be precise without being verbose. If everyone knows what DIN EN ISO 9001 certified means, you don't have to explain it every time.
And this connects to something deeper in German engineering philosophy, a concept called Funktionstüchtigkeit, the idea that a product should perform its function reliably over a long period, and that this matters more than how it looks or how cheap it was to produce.
The Japanese took to this with an intensity that surprised even Deming, from what I understand.
By the 1960s, Japanese manufacturing was competing on quality, not price, and JIS was part of that infrastructure. One specific standard that's relevant here is JIS Z8301. It governs the structure of technical manuals. The Edding 780 data sheet is 4 pages long, 4 pages for a marker. And it doesn't just tell you what it writes on, it tells you what solvents will remove it from each surface, because they anticipate that someone might need to remove the mark, and they want that person to succeed too.
That's the thing. It's not just about making the product work. It's about making the entire life cycle of using the product work, including the part where you need to undo what you did.
That's where the middle stand structure really matters. These are companies that have been owned by the same family for 3, 4, 5 generations. They're not optimizing for quarterly earnings. They're optimizing for, and I know this sounds almost spiritual, but it's how they think. They're optimizing for the company still being world class in 50 years. When your time horizon is generational, you invest in documentation because you know that documentation is what lets your customers trust you across decades.
The contrast with the American shareholder primacy model is pretty stark. If you're a publicly traded company and your bonus depends on this quarter's margins, you cut the technical writing budget. It doesn't show up in the numbers for years. It assumes the reader is competent, but possibly tired, possibly stressed, possibly working in poor conditions, and needs the information to be findable and unambiguous. American documentation often seems to assume the reader is either an idiot who needs everything explained, or an expert who doesn't need the manual at all.
There's a middle ground that gets lost. The German and Japanese approach respects the user's intelligence while also respecting the complexity of the task. It doesn't talk down, and it doesn't skip steps.
These middle-stand companies typically have very low debt. They're not leveraged to the hilt trying to maximize return on equity. They're self-financed through retained earnings.
In the 19th century, Britain was the industrial powerhouse. Germany was playing catch-up. And German manufacturers initially had a reputation for producing cheap knockoffs of British goods. And it creates what you might call a patient capital environment. The documentation team isn't a cost to be minimized. It's an asset that compounds over time.
That's beautiful. The badge of shame becomes the badge of honor.
If you fire the documentation team during a downturn, you don't just lose this year's manuals. You lose the institutional knowledge that was walking around in those people's heads. By the early 20th century, made in Germany had been completely inverted in meaning. It went from, this is cheap junk, to this is engineering excellence.
I remember reading about a German manufacturer of industrial printing presses. I think it was Koenig & Bauer, where the technical documentation archive went back to the 1920s. They had maintenance procedures for machines that had been in operation for 80 years.
There's also the middle stand factor on the German side. The middle stand are small and medium-sized enterprises, often family-owned, often in specialized industrial niches. They're not publicly traded, so they're not optimizing for quarterly earnings. That's the kind of thing that sounds absurd until you're the customer with the 1953 press and you realize the manufacturer still has your back. That's not just good service. That's a structural advantage. That customer is never buying from anyone else.
Okay, so let's fly to the other side of the world now. Completely different history. Completely different cultural tradition. But the output feels remarkably similar. What's the structural story there? And, on the Japanese side, you have something similar with the Kieretsu system historically. These interlocking networks of companies that share knowledge and standards across the supply chain.
And both systems create a consumer feedback loop that reinforces the behavior. In Germany, you have Stiftung Warentest, the product testing foundation, which has been operating since 1964. Mono means thing or object. Zukuri means making or crafting. But the compound word means something more than the sum of its parts. Monozukuri is the philosophy of making things with craftsmanship, with continuous improvement built into the process, with an almost spiritual attention to detail.
The American equivalent, Consumer Reports, doesn't treat documentation as its own scoring dimension in the same way. It might get mentioned in the review text, but it's not systematically evaluated. A government declaring manufacturing a cultural heritage asset. Meanwhile, in most Western countries, we spent the last 40 years telling kids that factory work was a failure bath.
And that law wasn't just symbolic. It funded training programs, it created centers of excellence. It sent a signal that making things well was a form of national achievement. But Monozukuri goes much deeper than a 1999 law. It connects to an older concept, Shokunin.
The master craftsman idea. He's researching modular storage systems for his move, and he's noticing that German and Japanese manufacturers disproportionately embrace modular design. Bosch's interchangeable tool systems, Muji's storage units. Why is modularity correlated with this documentation culture?
They're expected to notice when something is slightly off, to understand why it matters, and to stop the line if necessary. Every interface needs to be specified, dimensions, tolerances, load ratings, compatible materials. The documentation becomes the product, in a sense. The physical object is almost an instantiation of the spec sheet.
A company that's good at modularity has to be good at documentation. The two competencies are inseparable.
In some Toyota plants, this system has reduced defect rates to less than 1 per 100,000 vehicles. The documentation for each tool includes cross-reference tables for compatible accessories. You can look up exactly which batteries work with which chargers and which tools. That's the key insight. The Andon system creates a demand for excellent documentation.
The Muji storage units. Daniel mentioned looking into those. The documentation includes load-bearing calculations for each shelf configuration, because the Japanese market expects to know exactly how many kilograms each combination can hold. It's not. This shelf is sturdy. It's this shelf, in this configuration, with these brackets, anchored to this wall type, can hold 32 kilograms.
That specificity is the through line. It's the opposite of what you might call vibe documentation, the kind where the manual says attach securely without telling you what securely means. German and Japanese manuals tend to define their terms. Securely means torqued to 12 newton meters using a number 10 hex key.
So a worker doesn't have to interpret an abstract drawing. They just compare what's in front of them to the photo. If it doesn't match, they pull the cord.
That's a perfect example of what I mean by documentation that's designed for the actual user.
On the Japanese side, Takata airbags, a defect that killed people, covered up for years, leading to the largest automotive recall in history. The company that was supposed to embody monozukuri ended up embodying its opposite.
That's Shokunin applied to documentation.
This is where Japanese documentation differs from German documentation in a really interesting way. German manuals tend to be systematic and text-heavy. Here are all the steps. Follow them in order. Japanese documentation is often more visual and more contextual.
The MUJI assembly instructions are the perfect example. MUJI modular storage systems come with exploded diagrams, no text at all. Pure visual communication. It works across every language, every literacy level, every cultural context. A German manual would give you torque specs in newton meters. A MUJI diagram shows you a picture of the screw going into the hole with a little arrow indicating the direction of rotation. And somehow, that's all you need.
It's the difference between systematic thoroughness and contextual thoroughness. The German approach says, here is every piece of information you might possibly need, organized logically. The Japanese approach says, here is exactly the information you need at the moment you need it, presented in the way that's easiest to absorb.
Both are forms of thoroughness. They're just thorough about different things. The Japanese approach is thorough about anticipating user errors.
Though I'd argue that good documentation extends product life. If the manual helps you repair something instead of throwing it away, the net environmental impact might be positive. But it's a fair point that not every product needs a 50-page booklet.
Let's talk about where these systems came from historically, because the parallels are striking. Germany's late industrialization in the 19th century forced it to compete on quality rather than cost. That difference reflects deeper cultural assumptions about authority and expertise. In the German tradition, the documentation is authoritative. It's the voice of the engineer speaking to the technician. The assumption is that the technician is competent and wants complete information. In the Japanese tradition, the documentation is more like a guide or a teacher. It's designed to help the user succeed, even if they're not an expert.
The German approach respects the user by giving them everything. The Japanese approach respects the user by anticipating their struggles.
And both are forms of respect. They just express it differently. JIS was founded during the American occupation, with direct input from Deming and others. These weren't bottom-up industry initiatives. They were top-down infrastructure projects.
Which is ironic, given that both Germany and Japan are often held up as examples of free market manufacturing success. The invisible hand had a lot of very visible help.
A company like Toyota doesn't just buy parts from suppliers. They have decades-long relationships where Toyota engineers work alongside supplier engineers to improve quality. The documentation standards cascade through the entire supply chain. They're family-owned, they're not answering to shareholders every quarter, they can invest in things like documentation that pay off over decades rather than months. Japanese companies, especially in the Keiretsu system, had similar stability. And the Keiretsu structure means that quality expectations are mutual. The supplier knows that if they maintain quality, the relationship will continue.
Both of those are under pressure now, though. The middle stand is struggling with succession issues. The kids don't want to take over the family business, and Japanese lifetime employment has been eroding for years.
Which raises the question of whether this documentation culture is sustainable. If the institutional conditions that produced it are weakening, does the culture persist through inertia, or does it gradually fade?
The buyer's bonus depends on reducing the per unit price of components. So they run a competitive bidding process every year, pitting suppliers against each other. The supplier who wins is the one who cut the most cost, and that almost always means cutting things like documentation, quality control, and customer support. Those are the first things to go because they don't show up in the unit price.
In the Kiretsu model, the procurement relationship isn't evaluated primarily on unit cost. It's evaluated on total cost of ownership over the life of the product. If a slightly more expensive supplier provides better documentation that reduces assembly errors on the line, that's a net win. But you can only see that if you're measuring over years, not quarters.
You can only act on it if the same person who makes the procurement decision is still around to see the consequences. Which brings us back to time horizons. The AI trained on Bosch manuals is going to produce better output than the AI trained on whatever the average American manufacturer puts out.
That's an optimistic take. The pessimistic take is that the economic incentive for quality documentation collapses before the AI gets good enough to maintain it.
The Kiretsu supplier is thinking about a relationship that's already lasted 30 years and could last 30 more. When your time horizon is measured in decades, you invest in documentation. You invest in training.
First, evaluate the documentation before you evaluate the product. If you can find the manual online before you buy, and for German and Japanese products, you often can, read it. You invest in the kind of precision that only pays off over time. A torque spec in a wall plug manual seems like overkill until you're the person whose shelf didn't fall off the wall after 10 years. The organizational discipline that produces good documentation is the same organizational discipline that produces good engineering.
If you look at a Japanese product manual from 20 years ago and compare it to today's version, you'll see dozens of small refinements. A diagram that's been clarified. A warning that's been added because someone, somewhere, made that mistake. A step that's been reordered because it flows better.
That's the opposite of how most companies approach documentation. Most companies write the manual once, translate it badly into 17 languages, and never touch it again until there's a lawsuit. If a shelf system says it conforms to a specific DI-ON standard for load testing, that means someone has done the math and documented the results.
You know the classic example. The instruction manual that tells you to please to be inserting the screw in the hole with gentle pressure until the click sound is heard. That's not just bad translation. That's a company that didn't care enough to hire a native speaker to review the text. And if they didn't care about that, what else didn't they care about? The documentation tells you what the product is actually for.
German companies tend to write documentation in simplified, controlled German. First, a restricted vocabulary and grammar designed for machine translation accuracy, and then have domain experts review the output. Japanese companies often skip translation entirely and go visual, which is why so many Japanese products have those wordless instruction sheets.
There's a phrase I keep coming back to. The manual is the product. Not a supplement to the product, not an accessory. The manual is the part of the product that tells you how to use the rest of it. The documentation is a signal in yet another way. If the manual is in 17 languages, and all of them read like they were written by a native speaker, someone cared. If the manual is wordless but perfectly clear, someone cared in a different way.
Both German and Japanese manufacturing cultures understand this at an institutional level. It's not that individual German or Japanese engineers are more conscientious than their American or Chinese counterparts. That's why the documentation is such a good signal. If a company treats the manual as a living document that improves over time, they're probably treating the product the same way.
Which brings us back to where we started. What can we actually do with this? If you're not a German Mittelstand CEO or a Japanese Shokunin, how do you apply these lessons? Standards bodies that create a shared language of quality, legal frameworks that make documentation a liability shield, consumer expectations that reward thoroughness, and industrial structures that prioritize long-term reputation over short-term margins.
If the manual is a badly translated single sheet with no troubleshooting section, the product was built to be sold, not to be used. Any country that wanted to build this kind of engineering culture could do it. It just requires a multi-generational commitment to institutions that most political systems aren't set up to sustain.
The real question for the listener isn't, should I buy German or Japanese? It's how do I recognize quality systems, regardless of where the product comes from? The country of origin is a heuristic, not a guarantee. The documentation is the tell.
Philips makes shavers for consumers, but they also make medical equipment where documentation is literally life or death. The documentation standards from the B2B side carry over to the consumer products.
During the interwar period on Sao Tome and Principe, plantation workers on the cocoa estates consumed a fermented beverage called Vinho de Palma, made from the sap of oil palms. The sap, collected in bamboo tubes, would begin spontaneous fermentation within 2 hours due to ambient yeasts, reaching an ethanol concentration of roughly 4% within 6 hours. By 24 hours, acetic acid bacteria had converted most of the ethanol to vinegar, yielding a drink that was chemically closer to a weak kombucha than to palm wine. Workers consumed it primarily for its B vitamin content, which supplemented a diet otherwise deficient in riboflavin and niacin.
Right. The German structure plus the Japanese context. That's a useful framework. When you find a product that delights you, that makes you feel like the people who made it actually care about your experience, there's almost always an institutional story behind it. Apprenticeship programs, standards committees, liability laws, consumer watchdogs. The romance of craftsmanship is built on a foundation of bureaucracy.
The test case is coming up. Daniel's move, the modular storage system he chooses, the markers he uses to label the boxes. Will the documentation live up to the product? Will the system be as modular in practice as it is on paper? These are empirical questions, and they're exactly the kind of questions that German and Japanese manufacturers have structured their entire industrial culture to answer in the affirmative.
In Japan, you've got a system built on rote learning and rigorous testing, producing workers who are comfortable with precision and standardization. Very different methods, but both produce a workforce that respects procedure.
In both cultures, there's a shared assumption that there is a right way to do things, and that learning the right way is valuable.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.